Good afternoon, everybody. You want to call into order the House Subcommittee on Higher Education for today, which is April the 8th. No, pardon me.
April 14th.
April 14th, 2011. We're going to open up a work session for the purpose of hearing amendments to House Bill 2297. So I'd like to call the folks forward that are going to be presenting those amendments to us. And Gina Wickstrom, I believe you are the carrier of this good news for us.
Thank you. Well, good afternoon. I'm Gina Wickstrom, the Executive Director of the Northwest Career Colleges Federation. I want to thank you for taking the time today to hear a little more information on this bill today. The amendment before you makes significant changes to the bill, but it still provides an opportunity to support the students that are in various and all of the career and education pathways here in the state of Oregon. The amendment accomplishes the following, and I'll try to be concise about this. It establishes a separate sub-account for career colleges in the Opportunity Grant. And it would be only for those institutions that are recognized as degree granting that are approved by the Office of Degree Authorization and that have at least one or more campuses that are actually housed in the state of Oregon. We request this change, frankly, because there is clearly heavy opposition about the inclusion of our students in the Opportunity Grant program, because it's felt that there will be an even stronger competition for very valuable dollars that are out there. So I do want to note, though, that the changes in the bill, the amendment, does not request any kind of funding for this biennium. We certainly recognize that these are very tough fiscal times for the state. So I want to make that clear. What it does call for is that there would be a provision that individuals, institutions, foundations, or other entities that would so wish can make contributions to that sub-account to actually seed it and perhaps get it going. It's also our attempt to show you that we're very serious about funding students that are attending career colleges. So effective 2013, then we hope there's sufficient funds in there that the students can begin applying for the sub-account opportunity grant. With that, the students that would be eligible, they would be given priority if the student is enrolled in a program that is documented at capacity in a public institution or a private institution, or if it's a student that is attending a program that is not available in another college in Oregon. And a few weeks ago when we were before you, you heard from an Art Institute student that she was in a program that wasn't offered anyplace else up and down the West Coast. So that would be an example of that. Those are kind of it in a nutshell. We certainly ask your support in this because, as you've heard me say many times before each of you, that we truly do not believe at the Northwest Career Colleges that a student should be penalized because of their choice of education. And we think that this amendment takes it one step further in supporting the students that have made significant sacrifices and who have indeed taken the initiative to gain the education and work toward a career that will actually change their lives and that of their students. So thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you, Gene. Appreciate that. Any questions or comments about that? I think the idea has merit. Obviously, the issue that we confront is the issue of available resources to put into that, but in a perfect world, you know, we would have ample resources for that, as well as, you know, to fully fund all of our other Oregon Opportunity Grant opportunities and so forth and so on. But, you know, I think there's one thing we have heard, you know, throughout our hearings that we've had on this committee is that there's just a tremendous need, and there's a lot of not just kids but other folks that are looking for career advancement, and they just need a little bit of a hand hand up or pull up, if you will, to be able to make that dream come true. And as we talk about economic development and, you know, economic revitalization in this state, I just would hope that we could begin to look at about investing in these opportunities as truly job creating opportunities as well. So that's certainly where I am at with this. But
thank you.
Josette, would you like to speak to these amendments? Any other questions for?
Yeah, I'm sorry, and I do too.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You want to come up, Josette? Let's go ahead.
Thanks for being here today.
Thank you.
So, third parties would be able to donate to the sub account. How else would that sub account be funded? And I'm sorry, I haven't read the hand engrossed version. How else would that sub account be funded?
Through the interest that is applied to the account as well. So we would be hoping that there are foundations out there that would be willing to support its students. We're hoping that student alumni associations would be willing to step up and help their fellow students get a leg up on a change in their lives. So, and individuals or individual institutions. That's as far as I've gotten at this point, is to come up with some methodology by which we can get the fund started so that students that are so needy have at least some methodology by which to get rolling on the program.
Can I follow up, Mr. Chair? Or whoever is in charge of the Oregon Opportunity Grant could make that decision as well as that in their discretion. How they allocate. So right now we'd have third parties being able to deposit in the sub account. Is there a provision in here that says the legislature, some other entity will allocate a portion of the entire Oregon Opportunity Grant to the sub account?
Co-Chair Johnson, Denver representative, I'm not sure. All I am aware of is that the current amendment calls for no funding for the current biennium. And as far as the legal side of what OSAC can do or not, I'm not the person to ask.
And I guess just a comment, Mr. Chair, is that I agree. I think this is a good idea. What I'd hate to do is to set up an account and have nothing in there.
Yeah.
It needs to be something in there besides just the name of a sub-account. So, thank you.
And I might just add, I think the idea behind setting up the sub-account is just to simply have something there that could be contributed in at some later point by a more benevolent legislature, let's say.
Our ship a comes more in. Affluent legislature.
Yeah.
When our ship comes in.
I think it's about
hopefully again, an empty sub-account.
Yeah, right.
Representative Denver,
thanks, Mr. Chair. And Gina, I really appreciate the intent behind these amendments and the effort to work on this. And I do appreciate the notion of the schools themselves, you know, coming forward and contributing to this. In many cases, these are very profitable entities, and it seems to me that they should be coming up with scholarships for the students in them. Do you have a sense of, you know, what the level of interest is among, you know, the different, you know, the corporate entities that are behind the schools?
Chair Denbro, this is a relatively new amendment, and the response that we have gotten from some of the corporate offices that we've talked to is that this is an interesting, unprecedented move, and that they are watching it closely and believe that it has merit. I have not gotten any level of financial commitment from any corporation at this point that would say, we're there, here you go. But when I have folks saying that they're absolutely interested and think it's a great concept, then it gives me hope to believe enough to come before you all and say that I think that the opportunity has merit.
Thank you.
I'd hate to see a zero account also.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right. And to follow up, what is the level of scholarships that are, extended right now by the schools? I mean, I know that students have access to federal Pell Grants and loans, but in terms of sort of in-house, you know, tuition waivers, you know, things like that, I realize it's more difficult, you know, within that model, but, you know, are there scholarship programs that help students?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And there are a couple of college presidents here in the audience today that, that could address what their institution does. I was just talking with the director of ITT who throughout the ITT system makes substantial scholarships to the students that are involved with robotics. And from where I sit, our association hosts a scholarship program called Careers That Work. We make available $1,000 tuition scholarships to every high school in Oregon to assist students that are headed to one of the participating career colleges. That funding, I would like to say, I have pools of millions of dollars that we could actually hand out to the students. But instead, the schools are the ones that actually give that scholarship to those students. So that's just one scholarship program. Each of the colleges have their own internal scholarship programs. I cannot tell you today exactly how much money is sent out by each of those colleges. There are varying sizes and varying opportunities, but each of them does, and I think they would be willing to share that information with you.
Thank you. And just one last follow-up. Yes, and that's kind of getting to my point. If mm-hmm. I wonder if a portion of those dollars that they're already extending to students in scholarships could be directed to this sub-account. I mean, if we could have a substantial amount, it, frankly, becomes easier for the legislature to commit to matching money that's
sure.
there.
Sure. So I have that same, maybe not necessarily intruding upon their current scholarship program, because that is their institutional passion, if you will, but that there would be the opportunity for a commitment to actually fund that so it isn't a zero account. I agree with you. I hope it's something that in the next 2 years that we can see a national, if you will, a beginning of something that is a great idea for our students and in partnership as private enterprises with the state of Oregon.
Thank you.
And that's what I like to hear, is that talk about public-private partnerships, because I really think that idea has merit. We're seeing that to some extent with ETIC and so forth, and love to see that fleshed out and developed even more. I wonder if you could, to follow up with Representative Dembrough's question about just the levels of scholarships that are currently existing, perhaps, or help from the institutions to their students. That'd be good information just to have as we go into the interim, I think, just to know what's happening and how we could encourage more of that. That would be great if you're able to compile that. Rep. Parker, do you have a question?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Sorry to have arrived late, and I will depart early also. C'est la vie. So what is average tuition? What portion of that is covered in a scholarship? And are those $1,000 scholarships that are made available to the high schools and doled out by those schools, are those recurring in multiple years for the students that receive them? Every bit of money helps pay for college, right? So I'm wondering if a high school conveys a $1,000 scholarship to a particular student to attend a particular program, does that student get to count on that $1,000 coming in subsequent years?
Excuse me. I love the spring, but
sorry.
I get... I was hoping that wouldn't happen, Chair. Average tuition, I don't know, because different programs have different costs. Average scholarship, I don't know. I'll get back to you with a scholarship list. As far as the Careers That Work scholarship program, if you will allow me, thank you, if you will allow me a little bit of extra time, I can share how that program works with you, because it has been administered through my association since 1999. Here's how it works, is each high school receives information that this scholarship is available. We do not select the student. The high school counselors select the student. And then the requirement is that awardee must be accepted for admission to the institution. If the student does start, then their scholarship is awarded in equal disbursements over that first fiscal year. That is the end of that scholarship. And the reason behind that is that we heard repeatedly from our high school counselors that they had difficulty getting these students that are on the fence whether to go on to post-secondary education or not. And they use this scholarship often as the carrot to get that kid off the fence. And if the kid isn't getting off the fence for $1,000, often the parent takes the foot and kicks them on into it. So it's a program that is embraced by the high school counselors. And I think I answered your question. So no, it ends at the first year, but its intent is to get them into something.
Follow up. Thanks. I would also like to see data on the persistence of those students in the programs. We've heard and seen online instances where people are not satisfied with what they have received at some institutions, and that they feel that there was a less than honest presentation made to them. A cynic might look at those $1,000 scholarships that are good for 1 year as fairly effective advertising to bring someone in.
Chair Johnson, absolutely somebody might look at it that way, but let me tell you how the high school counselors look at it. They think that it's an absolute tool to assist students that are headed to more non-traditional education, to something that works. A few weeks ago...
That's why I want to know if they stay in the program
Thank you. That was your question. And I have asked that very same question of the schools that participate in that, because some schools choose not to participate, and I question why. And it's because they want to make sure that the students that are indeed careers at work scholarship students are ones that succeed, so they can go back to those high school counselors and say, oh, by the way, Johnny graduated this year in welding or diving or whatever it may be. And I will get you those numbers.
Great.
I absolutely will do that.
Thank you.
Okay. That's it.
Hi. Good afternoon. Hello, Representative Johnson and members of the committee. It's a pleasure to be with you today. I'm Josette Green. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Student Assistance Commission, and I'm here to talk with you about House Bill 2297. OSAC is an organization that advocates for all students, so I am here as a neutral party to this bill. We advocate for all students regardless of sector, regardless of whether for-profit, non-profit. I myself personally am a product of private education as well as public, and have worked at a very esteemed for-profit school. So I've had experience in all areas personally, but I just want to assure you that I'm not here to talk with you about whether it's whether for-profit should have opportunity grant or not. I'm simply here to talk with you today about some administrative burdens that are created by the amendments of this. So two items. First of all, the definition of eligible institution is changed by these amendments. Currently, eligible institution is one that is Oregon-based. In our rules, we define that as one who is located and headquartered here in Oregon. So it's pretty easy to define. The amendments indicate that it's one or more campuses in the state. Now you might ask, well, simply just make rules based on that. And that makes sense. However, right now, because of some new federal rules out, we, including the Office of Degree Authorization, are in the process of defining what online education is, what is considered to be a campus or institution within our state. And so our recommendation is, at this point in time, because we're still in the process of trying to get our hands around some new federal regulations that were instituted last fall, is that we not change the current definition until we better can get a grasp on the current regulations that are out there, and then we will have a greater sense. What it does mean for OSAC is that we would have to spend more time defining an institution regardless. And today, institutions with technology They can be in any kind of format. They could be an employer-based program where an employer brings in a school. It could be a online program that has a practicum locally. It could be a school that simply rents a building for a period of time or every weekend. So what is an institution? We would need to spend some time on that. And we're not, because of new federal regulations, really equipped to be able to define that right now. So that's one item. We certainly can do it. The timing's just not right for us. The second item is the special fund. And certainly we can administer the special fund. We would have no difficulty were money to be put in separate. We'd have some programming costs and time. We can make that happen. What it does, however, is ask that the Office of Degree Authorization indicate whether all degree programs are subject to capacity. Office of Degree Authorization does not perform this task now. What it requires of them would be to know all institutions across the state, all programs in all institutions, and be able to gauge their capacity. So with that, it would take, again, that is not an activity that the Office of Degree Authorization currently does. What they do is to review programs for schools who have not been in the state for at least 5 years, et cetera. So that would require additional administrative burden to be able to handle that, the elements of that fund. So for that reason, and for this year, and as Gina was talking about, the idea that it wouldn't be go into effect till a later time, we ask that that the bill go through as is and without amendments, or the amendments be altered so that we can effectively administer those. So those are my comments, and I appreciate the time to talk with you today, and I welcome any questions.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Questions for Josette? Rep. Dimbrough?
I'd just like to follow up on Rep. Lindsay's question earlier about, you know, assuming that, you know, at some form, at some point in time, the amended version did become law, how would you disperse or know how much to disperse? So would that be a function of what was contributed to the subaccount plus what was deliberately allocated through the ways and means process? That is, through the ways and means process, some money would be allocated to the main opportunity grant fund and then others specifically directed. So that would be the question.
Okay. Thank you for the question, Representative Johnson, Representative Dimbrough. That would actually be pretty simple programming on our part. And what if the funds were part of the entire pool of opportunity grant, we would simply award them as we do any other student, assuring that the student is an eligible student and ensuring that it's an eligible institution the student wishes to attend. If it were a sub-account, again, it would just really be a matter of programming so that we would, by the institution that the student indicates in their FAFSA, their free application for federal student aid, we administer it by the first school they listed. And if their first school is a for-profit institution, then we would award them against the fund that is indicated for for-profit institutions or students attending those schools. So we can do that.
So it sounds like there's still some gray area about what is an institution, a qualifying institution. Do you have ideas about how we can refine that as we go forward? What type of process and so forth and so on and all the players, and how do we determine exactly who would be eligible and who is not?
Mm-hmm.
I think that's one of the questions that I think, you know, will be dealt with as we or be considered as we go forward from here as a part of the higher ed process that we are going to grapple with and wrestle with as we go forward out of this session.
Thank you, Representative Johnson, for the question. The question you present is very interesting in these given times. Currently, the statutes indicate they need to be Oregon-based.
Mm-hmm.
And again, rules indicate Oregon-based is located and headquartered in Oregon. Is that appropriate for today's technology? today's current teaching practices? I don't know, because things are moving forward. And so I do believe that it would make sense, and I think this is a very good item that this bill brings forward in the amendments, is perhaps to assess for the entire state what is appropriate, so that we certainly want eligible institutions here that can meet the needs of our students and meet their training needs and their future professional goals. So we would want that. I do believe at this point, because of new regulations that have occurred and impact our Office of Degree Authorization, I believe they're in a good position to help us move forward on that question, as they're trying to wrestle with that right now and their approvals and understanding this. And I think as they get that process together, I'd be better able to answer that question. But we're right in the midst. Right now they have 65 schools that have come forward with online programs and programs that also incur some actual presence within Oregon, and that number is growing on the average of about 15 a week. They do not yet have, they're in the process of formulating the definition of that school and know where they stand with that. But with online programs and all the various kinds of education today, yeah. I was talking with the office on my way here to say, can you give me any idea of numbers? We have no idea. It's large. Very large. So I hear your question. I think it's a very viable one. I think it's very appropriate for us to answer that question, and I'd like to get back to it in about 6 months. And I think that would be a good time.
That sounds great. We all like to get back here in 6 months.
Or maybe not.
Well, I appreciate everybody with your testimony there. That's likely all we can do with our work session with these amendments at this point in time. So I'll go ahead and close the work session on House Bill 2297.
Thank you.
And what I'm going to do is open an informational meeting on career schools and career colleges. And we have a list of people who will be providing information to the committee. We also have some tentative timelines for each individual and so forth. And I'm going to be very judicious about how we use our time, or we're not going to get through our list of folks. So Gina Wickstrom, would you please come up and begin?
Yes.
And your students, okay? Gina and friends, please come forward.
May I pull it to?
Yep.
Members of the committee, Chair Johnson, Chair Dembrough, again, I'm Gina Wickstrom, the Executive Director of the Northwest Career Colleges Federation. Thank you for having us back and to be able to share some information about career colleges and the students that we serve. We have three students here representing different institutions and different programs, and we thought if it appropriate that each of the students would take a few minutes and share with you information about their background and what school they're enrolled in and what their expectation of that education is. And to my far right is Mike. He is with ITT Technical Institute. Belinda is just graduated last week from Concord Career Institute. And Rob is with Art Institute. He may look familiar to a couple of you. He joined us last time. He's willingly come back and is going to update us and share information about his career choice and where he's headed as well. So with that, Mike, perhaps you would just go ahead and you probably need to pull the microphone over.
I'm sure you can hear me. But my name is Michael Adams. I'm 48 years old, turned 49 this year. My history is I graduated in 1980. I started building computers with a firm here in Salem. And I wanted to further my career in computers, but it just wasn't available at the time. In 1980, computers were just starting to come into the main fair. I went to school at Chemeketa, and I actually knew more about computers than the instructors there, so I decided to stop going to school there and started teaching myself computer-aided drafting. I got to know enough about computer-aided drafting to where I went to the Oregon Employment and got a job in Portland. I worked for a structural engineer and then went into electrical engineering and did that for the last 20-plus years. As of April of 2009, I lost my job due to economic downturn, and I didn't know what to do. So I had a couple months to think about it, and my son, who just turned 21 today, or 2 days ago, decided he wanted to be in the gaming design. So we went to ITT. He was pretty much bent on going there. So I went with him, went through the initiation, and looked at the school and thought that it was a good school for him to go to. I had no career choices at that time, and as far as college, I didn't really think about it. I sat down with my wife, and we started thinking about our options, and there really wasn't much out there. My degree of engineering, there wasn't enough work out there for me to even think about going back to work, so I went to college instead. I'm currently enrolled for a computer network, and I'll be graduating in June with an associate's. I will be going back and doing a project management bachelor's, and when I graduate that, I'm going after a master's in project management. I just currently gained employment out of Intel, and so that's kind of my story in a nutshell.
That's great. Thank you. Appreciate it.
My name is Belinda Highfield. I am 28 years old. My story is a little bit different. I've been working full-time, taking prerequisite classes at Portland Community College one at a time, and then I had a daughter. By the time she was a year old, I was really wanting to apply for the radiography program at Portland Community College. I got all my prerequisites done, and I handed in my application. He smiled, put my application in a big pile, and said, "Good luck, there's about a 4-year waiting list." I had a 1-year-old, and I couldn't wait 4 years. So I looked at different opportunities around Portland, the Apollo College, Heald College. I didn't want to do computers, so that's not my forte. I ended up going to Concord Career College. It was either between the respiratory therapy program or surgical tech. And respiratory therapy program really, I think, suited me a lot well. I just really liked helping people. I wanted to be in the healthcare. I knew that from the beginning. After passing all of my administration exams and everything, I got enrolled. And honestly, I wanted to quit after the first week because going to school 5 days a week, working on the weekends, having a daughter, it was pretty overwhelming, and I didn't know how I was going to pay for it all. Financial aid really sat me down. I'm going to cry because they really helped me, like, and I would not be here today without them. So, so that's my story pretty much in a nutshell. I'm a recent graduate respiratory therapy program, and my daughter's 3 and a half, and we're going to have a great life. And I really feel it's because of that school. Sorry. I didn't think I'd cry.
Thank you. Chair Johnson, members of the committee, thank you for your time, first of all. You may remember me. My name is Robert Lacoste. Currently, I am enrolled at the Art Institute of Portland. I'm pursuing an industrial design degree. Among other things, since I've been at the Art Institute, I'm now president of the Honor Society, treasurer of our chapter of IDSA, which is the Industrial Design Society of America, as well as the treasurer of the student government that we maintain. So in most respects, the for-profit institution I attend currently is much like, in terms of extracurricular opportunities, very similar to the University of Iowa, where I obtained my initial degree in English and education. Essentially, I went to school in Iowa, freshly after graduating high school on the North Shore of Chicago. I obtained, as I mentioned, a degree in English and education. I substitute taught for a while. The pickings were pretty slim for full-time high school educators in the field of English in Iowa, and my interstate opportunities were rather limited without full-time experience of a minimum of 2 years. It was at that point that I started to explore my other opportunities. Found my real passion was for screen printing and graphic arts, and that led me to basically analyze the options that were available. I had always been interested in the Northwest, and I found that I had a distinct fit with the Art Institute of Portland's industrial design program because it was hands-on. I'd always been a fan of carpentry, but I wanted to, you know, pursue it in a more professional lineage. Getting out here, I can't sing its praises enough. I mean, it is really what you put into it, and I'm putting my all into it this time around, especially because it's career-oriented. Most of my instructors are already active in the field. We actually only maintain one technical full-time faculty in our department, specifically for the reason that the other faculty members have professional obligations aside from instructing the students. Do folks have any questions? I'd be more than happy to answer them.
I actually do, at the risk of dredging up more emotion. But you mentioned financial aid. Mm-hmm. I'm just curious maybe what your needs were and what the college is actually able to provide for you.
I submitted my FAFSA application. They offer scholarships. I was able to get the Imagine America scholarship. I've also got a Perkins loan, the Pell Grant. So I was able to stay in school and not have to pay out of pocket at that time. So. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, that helps a lot.
Okay.
It just sees the collaboration to help you through the process, for one thing, and make sure you knew what you were eligible for and how to obtain that help. So that's key for some folks.
Yeah, they helped me out immensely. They found all that they could.
Good report.
Can I follow up on that?
Yeah.
Thanks. Yeah. So, you know, more with the financial aid. So have any of you received financial aid from the institution? I mean, aside from the governmental aid, you know, institutional grants and scholarships and how much and...
Yes, I actually was the recipient of a winner scholarship of $1,000. That was, we're in spring terms, that was last term, for which I had to apply during the fall term. Since then, there's been a little bit of retooling, so we're not exactly sure where the budget for the next fiscal year is going to fall. However, in the positions that I maintain at Art Institute, I'm in constant contact with Jason Cleary, our Dean of Student Services, as well as our scholarship coordinator. And through the IDSA, there are also other scholarships available that we try and encourage and coordinate with that society.
Mm-hmm. Thanks. And Belinda?
We didn't have any scholarships, but they did pay for all of our certifications, so all of our BLS, ACLS, NRP, PALS, CRT, RRT, all of that was equal to about $1,000. So.
And you did mention that you received the Imagine America scholarship.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
For how much?
It was
$1,000. Well, those are great stories. It's just great to see, you know, sometimes... the world has, you know, difficulty navigating through from one phase to another, but then a door opens up, and it's great when it works out for you. And I'm glad to hear your lives are heading in the direction that you are encouraged by and that the colleges were there for you. So that's cool. Glad to hear that. Rep. Springer has a comment. Please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I love your stories, so thank you for sharing those with us. So... I'm assuming, and this may be wrong, that when you signed up for a program that you paid a fee for that whole program. Would that be correct?
Yeah.
Because you'd mentioned some other fees, so I want to talk about those a little bit. So you signed up and paid for a program.
Mm-hmm.
So then were those fees for the certifications and the licensing part of that process there?
I'm not really sure.
Okay. Okay. Thank you.
I'm sorry.
No, that's okay.
Okay. Okay, well, thank you.
I have some more?
Okay.
Yes, thanks, Mr. Chair. Belinda, this is to you because you're in respiratory tech. One of the concerns that I've heard about some of the for-profits who are involved in the health field is they're having challenges getting placements in area hospitals. And can you tell us a little bit about your experience with your clinicals and, you know, get that kind of experience?
Absolutely. Yeah. My program is a little bit different from the other programs in the state, like Mount Hood or Lane. They only offer about 600 clinical hours, and we offer 900 clinical hours. And so it gives us pretty much 3 months more than they have gotten. We've got an excellent rapport with all of our clinical sites, multiple job offers. We've only been graduated a week, and four people from my class out of 15 have already gotten job offers, two at OHSU, one in Florida. So there's not really any problem looking for jobs right now for us.
But that's great.
Yes.
And where did you get to do your clinical rotations?
All over the Portland area, because I have my daughter that I had to kind of stay close. We went to OHSU. We went to Salem Hospital. I went to Portland Providence, St. Vincent's Hospital, the Vibra Specialty Hospital. I think that's it. That's all that I've gone to, but we've also have a lot of other clinical sites lined up as well that other people were able to go to.
Great. And one further question. Another concern that's been expressed to me that I'd like to address is that students aren't always fully informed when they enroll about the debt load that they're going to be carrying and, you know, what the monthly payments will be and, you know, that kind of thing. Could you tell us something about, and you know, and all three of you, you know, about how that process worked for you?
Yeah, I can start that. When I enrolled, they were very forthcoming because at the time I enrolled, I was unemployed. I was living on unemployment with a family of five, with a mortgage, a car payment, the typical things you have to deal with when you have a job. So money was very important to where it was coming from. They spelled out everything, how much I was paying a term, how much the term was costing, where the money was going, what my grants were paying for, what the FAFSA was taking care of, and what I had left over, and how much I had to get in loans. That was clear to understand right away. So that was for ITT, they spelled it out right away. They didn't hide anything.
I had much the same experience. At Art Institute, every student has a drawn-out financial plan, which predicts the cost as it increases between fiscal years of tuition and how much the total cost at the end will be. And we actually have checkpoints, I believe, every two terms in which the students are required to meet with their financial planner, just make sure everyone's on the same page, that the funding is being acquired and allocated appropriately, and that basically they're going to be able to graduate on budget, on schedule.
Mm-hmm. So if I could follow up. So Rob, what will your monthly payments be when you graduate?
I have been fortunate enough to not have to resort to FAFSA. My family has been very supportive. My grandfather made arrangements before he passed so that my brother and I were looked after. If you're wondering, my current payment per term is approximately $5,700 for four classes, and I will be graduating in 1 year.
Yeah. Ms. Springer?
What is a term?
A term, we have 11-week terms and a 10-week summer term, so you can fit four terms in 1 year, technically.
Additional questions? Thank you. You have something else to share with us, please?
I am not anything with computers. I mean, I want to punch a button and go. And so there we go.
It's going.
Just like that.
Whoops.
You mean like that
don't
way?
Go that much.
Like that.
Is that what you wanted? Ask and you shall receive.
So I wanted to share a little bit of information with you while we have the opportunity today to provide a little bit more insight into who are the Oregon Career Colleges and provide that information to you. As you've heard from our three students today, that we do generally offer some unique educational experiences. And people say to me sometimes, well, why would a student go to a private career college when they could go to a community college so much cheaper? And I think that you've heard today some of those, and a few weeks ago, some of those responses. But generally, we have very small classes. We have hands-on education. And as Mike was speaking, flexible schedules that allow people to actually get on with their lives as well as earning their degrees or going toward their career goal. And one of the biggest pluses for our sector is that because we are accountable for field-related employment, not only field-related employment, also persistence, meaning that we can only experience a limited number of incompletes in our programs. We have effective field-related employment assistance in our schools to help our students get jobs. And then some of our colleges, as you've heard in the past, also have lifetime guarantees to assist students with resume, skill update, and that kind of thing. So that appears to be a very positive opportunity for our students. In 2009, about 20,000 students enrolled in Oregon's career colleges. 68% of those were women and 22% minorities. You asked some questions about financial aid. 61% of our students were Pell Grant recipients, and 80% of those students received some form of financial aid, a combination of grants and loans in the most instances. What do we do? What do we do for Oregon as far as helping prepare employees? 93% of the culinary awards in the state of Oregon that were conferred came out of Oregon private career colleges. Some of you are very familiar with Western Culinary Institute, now Le Cordon Bleu. It's been around since the early 70s. They educate many people from many states who come to Portland for the sole purpose of remaining in Portland because it's like the restaurant place of the world. 41% of the Allied Health awards come from our institution. 67% of all certificates, those are the non-degree certificates. Only 12% associate degrees, and that means about 6,000 students receive some sort of award from our institution. 12 of the colleges are degree granting. Those are what we were talking about with Josette. And you can see from this list, it's a broad array of programmatic offerings and either associate or bachelor degree. Some of these are very heavy in the allied health programs, some technology, and of course Art Institute is the sole art type programs that are out there. And then University of Phoenix is of course the largest for-profit institution on planet Earth, and they offer more academic type programs. I will state that I can't speak for University of Phoenix because they are not a member of our association. A little bit about the oversight. I know that's of great interest to this committee to ensure that there is that accountability by our sectors. Four of the degree-granting colleges are regionally accredited, and 8 are nationally accredited. I thought I'd explain kind of the fundamental background on what's the difference between regional and national. Regional is historically, they were established for more academic-type profiles. And the national organizations were organized because they were more technical. They were the guys that did the welding, the more hands-on kind of stuff. Over the years, that has more melded a little bit, but that's the background. When we say national, it means that they aren't assigned to just a specific area or a certain number of states. It means that they have the authorization to accredit schools across the nation and some even international. We are regulated in part by a triad. It starts with state oversight. It then includes the Department of Education if the institution is approved to participate in federal student financial aid. And then also, as we mentioned, the accrediting agency. So there is literally three oversight agencies that are absolutely, and I will use this word, breathing down our necks, especially in this time, to ensure that the schools are doing exactly what they're supposed to do to uphold the standards that are set before them. ODA oversight is not easy. It is not easy. In fact, I tell some of my schools across the nation that if you can get ODA oversight, then you're probably good to go in some other states. They do, as you all are aware, very very specific approvals. And then in August or September, it was, they actually extended the rules to include a provision at ODA that accounts for student completion, student retention, and then student field-related employment. And it's very specific that in the employment field, it can't be part-time, it has to be secured within 6 months, and it needs to be permanent. So that changed the whole profile of what the state was requiring, and the schools have stepped up and certainly are adhering to that oversight. They also do a lot of auditing oversight and making sure that the schools are upholding what they're supposed to do. The Oregon Department of Education licenses five accredited institutions, and they do a number of consumer protection provisions to ensure that the student that is paying a school for an education is actually getting the education that they are promised. This includes that monitoring of the institution's finances to ensure that they have sufficient ability to deliver the product that they are enrolling to deliver. And then a couple of you have talked to me and asked me about the GAO study. In fact, when we were here last time, I didn't get the opportunity to talk about that. This is a very important issue. In August of last year, the GAO performed an undercover sting operation in 14 colleges, primarily in the South and up the East Coast. And they went in as potential students. They were inquiring about enrolling in the schools. When the report was delivered to the Senate Help Committee in September, I cannot even describe to you the collective gasp and horror that was experienced across the nation. And those of us that work closely with it know that broad brush drips that can be absolutely devastating. And it was. Subsequent to the August report, the information about the study became public knowledge. It was scrutinized, and thusly in November, the GAO reissued the study, removing 14 of the findings, finding that the report was inaccurate and misleading in how they delivered that information. So I want to tell you that the schools that I represent and our association have absolutely zero tolerance for anything that would be misleading or misrepresentative to the students that entrust their education to us. We truly believe that if fraud is committed, the people should go to jail. And if it's misleading information, then they should be corrected. And it is something that shall not be tolerated and should not be tolerated, and we work daily to ensure that the integrity and the ethics that goes along with the schools of Oregon is adhered to, and that we continue to be student-focused and provide the education that we believe is absolute value. Thank you very much for listening to us today.
Thank you. It's a very thorough report. Good to see all of that again. Any other follow-up questions? We need to keep moving with our rest of our panel today. So
I just want to say I appreciate your comments about ODA.
Mm-hmm.
Gina, I've heard that Oregon is much better positioned than most other states because of that agency.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Red Moss first. Okay. Oh.
Go ahead,
Bob. Go ahead, please. And we are calling Cheryl Cosgrove, who is an RN with the Oregon State Board of Nursing.
Hello?
Hello, this is Representative Johnson. You're speaking to the House Subcommittee on Higher Ed. How are you today?
I am fine, thank you.
Great. Would you like to share with us a bit about your perspective on career colleges and how it pertains to your nursing program and so forth?
I would be happy to do that, Chair Johnson and members of the committee. My name is Cheryl Cosgrove, and I'm a registered nurse from LaGrande, Oregon, and I'm also a member of the Oregon State Board of Nursing. I have a master's degree in nursing and 33 years nursing experience and currently work as a critical care nurse at Grand Lawn Hospital. I would like to share some information about for-profit nursing programs, career schools, and some of the challenges students encounter with these programs based on my experience as a member of the Oregon State Board of Nursing. The Oregon State Board of Nursing approves or denies nursing programs based on the school's ability to meet Division 21 educational standards. Some of the concerns that I have about the for-profit nursing programs are that the cost to students oftentimes for a two-year degree from a career school versus a community college can be two times or higher than the cost of a community college. And since I originally graduated from a community college many years ago, I think that that additional cost on the student to get the same degree is something to consider. Also, career schools have a real lack of clinical sites. Some of the programs that have come before the State Board of Nursing have clinical sites that are not even based in Oregon, and students are traveling 100 miles or more from their original program, which is based in Portland, to Washington to have the ability to get some acute care experience in a small hospital. The Portland market and the urban markets in Oregon are flooded with nursing programs, and the lack of clinical sites is a real challenge. Career schools often look for clinical sites in nursing homes and outpatient clinics and doctor's offices rather than hospitals. And as a hospital nurse with lots of critical care experience, I know how important it is for nursing students to get that hospital experience and so they can attain those jobs in hospitals when they graduate. My other concern is that career schools are fighting in the state to bring in instructors to teach these programs. In Oregon, there is a real lack of nursing instructors, and many of the current nursing instructors will be retiring within the next 5 to 10 years. And so these career programs come in, and they compete for nursing instructors that are already teaching in our schools that have a long history of nursing education in the state of Oregon. So the adequacy of resources, adequate resources for these programs is a problem. My other concern is that most career schools, and this is a big concern of mine, are not regionally accredited. They are nationally accredited, but they're not regionally accredited. So non-career schools don't accept their credit transfers. What this means is if you go to a career school and get a two-year nursing degree and then you decide that you want to go to a non-career school to get a bachelor's degree or a master's degree, then you, because these credits don't transfer, you have to take, students have to take on the additional cost as well as time to repeat these courses in order to be able to move on to the next tier in their nursing education. And that is an additional cost and burden for the students. And the other difference in career schools is that most career schools are year-round with their admissions, so they can have multiple admission times of new students and multiple graduation times during the year. This has a larger impact on clinical sites and use of resources because you, instead of having students that are admitted at the beginning of the fall and end up graduating a couple of years later, they can come in at different times in the program and graduate at different times in the program, and that's a greater stress on the clinical sites themselves. And in summary, career schools are run as a for-profit model, and that is a business model that looks at the market profit and not on the entire education system. And my concern there is that they are not linked to Oregon's educational system. They are a for-profit model, and so the outcome of these career schools is that potentially students can graduate from them with less clinical experience in acute care hospitals and greater cost and debt that they have to assume upon graduation. And I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify on career schools, and I would like to ask if you have any questions.
Okay, thank you, Cheryl. Any questions for her from the panel, from our committee? Rep. Dembro?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Sharon, thank you for your testimony. So I know that because I'm seeing him in the room now, our friend from ITT Tech has recently begun a nursing program. So presumably to begin that program, they had to engage in a relationship with the Board of Nursing and ultimately receive the approval of the Board of Nursing. So can you tell us how that works and what it was about their proposal that made the board feel comfortable approving that? Thank you.
Yes, I can. When they came before the board for approval, they have to meet Division 21 educational standards, and those standards are based for all nursing programs that apply in front of the State Board of Nursing in order to operate in the state of Oregon. And ITT, when they came to us, and that was the first nursing program being a board member, that was the first nursing program that I had experience with coming in front of the State Board of Nursing. And at that time, I did not know as much as I know about career schools. Currently, because we have had other career schools come in front of us since then, looking to open up programs in the Portland area. And so when they came in front of us, they did meet the Division 21 educational standards. To my knowledge, they did not have a complete list of instructors that they were currently recruiting for those instructors, but they were able to find clinical placement sites. As a nurse, and I'm speaking personally with 33 years of experience, my concern is that the clinical sites are not the same as OCNI programs and Oregon Health Sciences University and some of the nursing programs that are in Oregon's educational system, where you have a rotation of students that come through. You have clinical instructors and nursing instructors that have been with their programs, some of them 25 years, and you have that continuity and that experience based with that school and those hospitals. We in LeGrand, Oregon have Oregon Health Sciences nursing program here at Eastern Oregon University, and we have had this program for over 20 years, and the students come in every fall and continue to do their clinical rotations with us, and we have the same clinical preceptors and the longevity of the program and clinical experience. And what I have learned as a new board member, that this is my third year on the board, and what I have learned about these career schools is that it seems like we're getting more and more requests for them, and I'm concerned as a nurse and as a Oregonian that we look at what it's doing to the entire market, and that we don't end up with having career schools basically on every corner and grinding these students through the program without them having the ability to work in some of the bigger institutions like Oregon Health Sciences University, different hospitals, and have the continuity of the program rather than having them placed in nursing homes and different clinical sites. And ITT did, they were the first program that I had heard from when I started on the State Board of Nursing. And if they came before us now, I'm not sure that I would have the same vote that I did at the time, because I've learned more about these programs, and my concern is that the students coming out of them aren't going to get the solid education that you would have from some of the programs that we already have based in Oregon. There's just a flooding of the market, and ITT would probably share with you, too, that they're placing their students, a couple here, a couple there, and students are traveling, some of them, quite a distance in order to get that clinical education. And I really feel that nurses nowadays, especially nurses that want to work in hospital settings, really need that strong clinical foundation and that base in order to launch into the very highly skilled, highly technical role of the nurse today.
Cheryl, I've got a question here from Representative Lindsay. And then we're going to have to move on because we're need to stay on our time frame here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Cheryl, I'm assuming that there's a pretty good licensing process in place for nurses. Do you have full confidence in that licensing process here in Oregon?
Oh, yes, I do. Yeah, I think the State Board of Nursing does a very good job licensing their RNs.
Okay. Follow-up then would be, if you have full confidence in that licensing process, why does it matter whether they're coming from a career college or a public college or any other college if they are passing the high hurdles of that licensing exam or process?
Well, yeah, I'm speaking personally as an experienced nerd. I think that when you have the experience in a as I said, a hospital setting, then your ability when you graduate to get a job that pays well, which hospitals do pay well, your ability based on your clinical placement in your clinical site, you can get an RN license, but your ability to get those jobs in the areas where you need greater skills is based on your clinical placement. And I think that if you're paying to go to school and you come out with an RN degree, that you should have the ability to step into some of those jobs with your current education. And one of the comments that was made by one of the career schools that we reviewed was that the clinical sites, most of them were based in nursing homes and outpatient areas. And one of the comments made was that, well, this would fill a niche for nursing home nurses. And when that comment was made, that was very concerning to me as an RN, because I think that when you graduate from a two-year program, I don't think there should be a difference between a nurse graduating from a two-year nursing program and the ability to work in any nursing setting. And if your main clinical experience is in a nursing home, it's going to be very difficult to take that transition and work in an acute care hospital. Mm-hmm. And that's a personal view of mine. I think that when you graduate from a nursing program, you should have the ability to work in the most critical environment or acute care environment that you choose.
One more quick follow-up.
And I agree, and this is more of a statement. I agree. And I certainly hope that if we are licensing nurses, that they're ready to jump into any of those things that we've licensed them for.
And they are... An RN license,
regardless of where they've graduated.
An RN works in a variety of different settings. And I feel like if you're paying a lot of money for an education, which you are with these career schools, quite a bit of money, then you should be able to go from there into the setting that you want to go into.
Well, thank you, Cheryl. Appreciate your testimony. I've been privileged to live with an RN for the last 30 years, so I appreciate your service.
And you are a lucky person.
Oh, I thank my lucky stars every day.
So many ways.
Yes, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you very much.
Okay, we need to move on now to Fred Boss, please. Would you come forward and share with us? And I've got you down for 5 minutes, okay? Thank you very much for your promptness in advance.
Chair Johnson. Co-chairs, members of the committee, my name is Fred Boss. I am Chief Counsel of the Civil Enforcement Division at the Oregon Department of Justice, and I'm here to give you a very brief accounting of the a class action lawsuit that has been filed on behalf of the Oregon Public Employees Retirement Fund against Apollo Inc., which is the operator of the University of Phoenix. This action has been filed in the Federal District Court down in Phoenix, Arizona. Oregon PERS is one of the lead plaintiffs in this action. The allegation is that PERS lost approximately $12 million in share value because of the disclosure of Apollo's false and misleading business practices. Among the allegations in the complaint, and I'll be I have a copy of the complaint here. I'd be more than happy to leave it here, or actually, I forgot to bring the requisite number of copies. But
I'm sure Representative Lindsay can decipher it for us.
Excellent. PERS has alleged, or the complaint alleges, deceptive marketing practices, materially false and misleading statements about compensation practices of the recruiters for the college, false and misleading statements about practices concerning the return of federal loan monies to students, and the deceptive recruiting practices to maximize the enrollments of students that are eligible for Title IV federal funds. Like I said, this is more just to alert the committee that there is this class action. The complaint was filed in February, so we're just at the beginning of that litigation, and it is in litigation, so I prefer not to discuss any strategy. But I would be more than happy to leave our 135-page copy of the complaint here, which goes into these in detail. I'll be more than happy to answer questions if I can.
Representative Lindsay. I'm sure you're aware that there are several class action suits against public universities as well, correct? For the exact same thing, deceptive marketing practices.
Co-chairs, Representative Lindsay, I am not aware of that.
Okay. I guess I'm just trying to say that career colleges aren't the only ones with, there's just plenty of mud, plenty of people with unclean hands as well.
Johnson, Representative Lindsay, I'm ignorant on that.
Do you know where does PERS attribute their losses? To what, how did the institution, how did PERS lose money? I don't get that.
PERS invested in Apollo Inc.
as an investment tool.
Correct.
For the PERS Reserve Fund, is that correct?
Correct.
Ah, okay. I get you. Well, they've invested in a lot of other things that haven't done exactly really well as well. Are we going to have class action suits with all of those as well? Yes.
Follow up. What is the purpose of this testimony related to this bill?
Co-chairs,
because the purpose of this bill is to extend the Oregon Opportunity Grant to career colleges, so I'm just wondering what the purpose of your testimony is.
I was, co-chairs, Representative Lindsay, I was asked by, I believe, a member of the committee to come and give a report on this. Beyond that, beyond giving a report on the class action lawsuit, that's the full purpose.
Representative, we're actually into just an informational session on career schools now, so we're not just pertaining to the bill. Rep. Hoyle?
Two things. Was this class action suit, I'm not a lawyer, so just some clarification. Is this because there were losses or because there were deceitful practices?
Co-chairs, Representative Hoyle, because there were losses.
Is it specifically, because again, I think as Chair Johnson said, there's lots of times and a lot of people who have made investments that lost money over the years. That in itself is not, you're not able to bring a lawsuit because you made a bad investment. However, is the lawsuit, otherwise it would be a lot of lawsuits.
It'd be a lot of lawyers.
A lot of lawyers. But is it not, from what I heard you say, is it not because there were some deceitful practices or there was some unethical behavior or illegal behavior?
Co-chairs, Representative Hoyle, that when PERS had an investment in Apollo Inc., when it was revealed that there were certain practices, then the market fell on those shares and PERS suffered a loss.
Nice.
So it's a little bit of both.
It is. Okay.
Okay. And then, sorry, go ahead.
I'd be happy to leave the complaint if you want to see it.
I think you'd like to get rid of the complaint.
Yeah. My second question is, I'm getting the sense that you're saying this because you want to say that possibly career schools are run differently than public schools. But Apollo Inc., can you tell me what does that have to do? How many of our Oregon for-profit schools are affiliated with Apollo Inc.? I guess I'm not familiar with the organization and with that particular company.
Co-Chairs, Representative Hoyle, I do not know. I was asked
maybe
simply to come.
Maybe I'll ask that question of one of our.
Okay. All right.
Okay. One more question here?
Yeah, thanks, Mr. Chair. How did the disclosure or the accusation of these deceptive practices happen? You know, do you know? I mean, was it the result of some kind of newspaper series? Or, I mean, what was it that spooked the market about the University of Phoenix? Was it a result of some kind of hearings? Or can you answer that?
Coach Ademiro, it was a combination of several things. There were... there was the GAO report. There was an NPR series. There were disclosures by the company itself. All of them.
Okay, I look forward to it. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Boss. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Teresa Green, please. Oregon Department of Ed.
They're one of those national groups that have branch campuses. They'd have to have an Oregon presence too.
Good afternoon. I'm Teresa Green from the Oregon Department of Education, charged with oversight for the private career school licensing program. And I was asked to come and just give a little bit more information about our program, what we do. So I've provided a handout for you that has some of the slides that we presented in the first session that we had. And then I've added just a little bit more information for clarification. So what you are getting there in front of you, the first three pages are those slides. And then I've also included a couple of excerpts from the statute that was referred to in here, just so that you've got that in front of you to refer to. So on that first page, it's just the same slides that were presented before. What are private career schools? There seemed to be an interest in what is the difference between private career schools and private career colleges. Those terms get used interchangeably, but I think there is a distinction. The determining factor for regulation falls around whether or not the institution is a degree-granting institution. So those institutions that grant degrees, and they can also have certificate programs, they fall under the regulation of the Office of Degree Authorization. So only those schools that do not grant degrees are with the Department of Education. So that little notation there, ODA versus ODE, on that first slide, that's what that means. So then again, you've got the types of schools, just as a reminder. And then I added a slide in here for types of certifications because there was an interest in what do they get and what does it allow them to do. And at the school level, the schools are required to issue a certificate of completion or a diploma, although that word diploma doesn't carry the same meaning as it does in K-12. They can call it a diploma if they choose to. And then that allows them in many cases to go on to get national certifications or their state licensing if that's involved, or other industry certifications that are out there. But generally the schools don't handle that. And then again, all our statistics about how many schools we have, how many students are enrolled, how many graduates, and then the legislative intent, and that's one of the excerpts that you have there, just reiterating that legislature at some point recognize that private career schools are a valuable addition to students' opportunities for furthering their education. And in the words they're embedded, what we kind of focus on is the fact that these schools are run by people who are in the industry versus in the public sector. So these are people who have a lot of connections in the industries for which they're training and can use those connections to help their students with placement and that kind of thing. And then moving on to the third page, I included some more about the minimum standards. There's the original slide that was in the first presentation, and then I expanded on that a little bit and included the subparts of the statute that each one of these pertain to, so that if you want to at some point just take a look at what the statute actually says about the minimum standard in these different areas, you've got that information. So that's all I have for you. If you've got some questions, I'm more than happy to answer.
Super.
Those for you.
Thanks for your brevity. Tell me, you said you get over 3,500 teachers. Are they covered by collective bargaining as a whole, or is each institution responsible for, they decide their compensation for their teachers? Is that how that works?
Coach Johnson, yes, there is no collective union for them.
Okay, super. Any other questions for Representative?
Thanks for sharing. I don't really have a question. I just want to make a comment, and that's, Teresa, I appreciate your work with us this session. I know you brought forward a number of bills, some of which we passed out, which have not been scheduled for a work session, and I apologize for that. I wish that we could be moving forward with them at this time, but it looks as if we're going to have to wait till next year. Is that going to create any problems for you, or in terms of let's say, ideally, a year's delay in us addressing some of the issues that those bills were trying to deal with?
Coach Johnson, Coach Dembro, thank you very much for those comments. I appreciate all of the work that you've done with us as well to help further the knowledge about what we do and move forward some of the things that we need. And I totally understand some of the challenges that the legislature's facing and the need to delay on those. Our biggest concern is, of course, the fee bill, because with many of the things that have been discussed today and that Ms. Wickstrom has brought forward as concerns in the field from the GAO report and everything, we've worked very hard to increase our oversight in terms of making sure that all the T's are crossed and the I's are dotted, and to try and take a preventative stance on some of these things. And that's a time-intensive and resource-intensive effort. And we are working with LD positions right now that if we don't get that funding bill through, I'm not sure at this point whether or not we'll be able to retain those positions. And so that will delay our work in enforcing some of these things. The other bills, they can wait. There's other things that we can do to address those needs. But that funding bill really is the big one.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
It's been great to see you during our time together this session. Okay, we got a duo coming up, John Bartholomew and Emma Galloway from the students. So please come forward.
Yeah, I think we lost John.
Oh, okay. Or we can just have Emma.
Oh. Or we could call the next group up.
He's here.
Oh. He's just receiving his marching orders. So
yeah, exactly. His talking points. Get off the reservation.
On a completely different issue.
You want me to go first?
I think you're first on the list.
Oh, okay. Co-Chair Johnson, Co-Chair Dembro, members of the committee, for the record, my name is John Bartholomew. I am policy advocate at the Oregon State Public Interest Research Group. And the reason that we care about this issue in particular is threefold. First of all, we're a student organization. I mean, we started at the University of Oregon 40 years ago this year, and we still have three chapters of student PIRGs in the state. And we want our students to get as good an education as they possibly can. can. Second, we're also a government watchdog group, and we want to make sure that our tax dollars are going to the most effective places they possibly can, so that we get the most bang for our buck out of our tax dollars. And as a consumer advocate, we want to make sure that consumers get their money's worth when they're told that you're going to get a certain product. We want to make sure they get that product. Now, my comments are not meant to paint a broad brush. What I would say about the education system in this state generally is that there is room for all kinds. And the public university system, community colleges, nonprofit, private colleges, as well as the for-profit colleges. I personally have friends and family who have graduated successfully from for-profit schools and been gainfully employed. And I think that the vast majority actually do a great job of providing services. But there's one major difference between them and the rest of the kinds of institutions, and that is that they are for-profit. And those that are publicly traded, which is many of them, are bound to produce returns for their shareholders. And due to that dynamic, they do have kind of a different set of incentives than universities and community colleges do. Most of the money for most of these for-profit colleges actually comes from federal money. There's a 90-10 rule that says that they cannot take any more than 90% of their money through federal student loan programs, and many of these schools cap out at about 89% of their revenues come from these sources. It's an industry that is growing significantly. Their percentage of overall students just in the past 5 years has doubled in terms of the overall student population. Now, I do want to say that there have been numerous complaints about practices at many of these for-profit colleges. And these complaints have led to government action. There's been several states, including California, North Carolina, Michigan, and Ohio, that have recently enacted new regulations on career colleges. Attorneys general in four states, Kentucky, Florida, Iowa, and Illinois, have launched broad investigations on for-profit colleges in their states. You've already heard about the investigation here in Oregon, the suit here in Oregon. And in addition to the state actions, of course, you've heard that Congress has been investigating the industry. And there was the GAO report that kind of was less than favorable towards at least the recruitment practices of many of these schools. The GAO did revise their report after some initial complaints, but they stand by their report, and it's that report that I cite statistics from. Now, the different kinds of complaints that we've heard have to do with aggressive and deceptive recruitment practices, that it's unreasonably difficult to withdraw from school, and that the degrees have questionable value both in terms of their usefulness and the high cost compared to other schools, and that they saddle students with massive amounts of debt. Some of the findings of the GAO report I'll just briefly go through. The undercover tests at 15 for-profit colleges revealed that four colleges actually encouraged fraudulent practices. Three of them suggested that the applicant not report $250,000 in savings so that they would be more likely to qualify for federal student loans. And two of the colleges suggested the applicant lie about their number of dependents so that they'd be more likely to qualify. And then at all 15 colleges, the undercover recruiters found some kind of deceptive or questionable statement, including one where a beauty college informed an applicant that barbers can earn $150,000 to $250,000 a year, when the truth is that 90% of barbers earn less than $43,000 a year. And two colleges told applicants they were guaranteed or virtually guaranteed employment upon completion of the program, even though federal regulations prohibit a school from misrepresenting the employability of its graduates. There's a lot more. I won't go into all of it. But the GAO report is not the only source of this kind of investigative work. ABC News did the same thing, found similar results. Whistleblowers that have come forward with the University of Phoenix that accused the university of violating federal financial aid regulations. Without admitting wrongdoing, the University of Phoenix did agree to pay $67.5 million to resolve the accusations. With these recruiting practices, there's also recently released internal documents from several for-profit colleges that I included at the back of my testimony that you should have that talk about how recruiters have been using pain and fear to attract low-income students. There's the pain funnel and pain puzzle that ITT Tech had been using. Kaplan was talking about, it's all about uncovering their pains and fears. Once they are reminded of how bad things are, this will create a sense of urgency to make the change. And Vatterott College, which is mostly in the Midwest, detailed their sales targets, including those who have dead-end jobs and no future, low self-esteem, and are fired or laid off.
Could you just stick to colleges that deal with Northwest schools?
Okay, Northwest.
Yeah, the Midwest institutions don't apply here.
Okay.
Did you have a question, Rep. Poyle?
Well, that really was my question. I think that it's important that we protect students and
yes.
We protect people from, we make sure that consumers understand what they're buying. But my question is, how many of the quotations that you had about things that happened were happening in Oregon schools?
Chair Johnson, Representative Hoyle, the information that I have from the GAO report and the other ones did not actually address Oregon colleges because they did not do the surveys here. So I appreciate your comment. And that goes to my overarching point, and that is that there is a role for these schools. But whenever we're looking at putting public resources into anything, whether it's a public institution, whether it's your school, your elementary school, or a for-profit college, we should make sure that we're getting our money's worth and it's a worthwhile investment for the taxpayers. So the question is, are they doing that here? I'm just wanting you to be sure you ask the questions.
And you began your presentation with saying you weren't going to paint with too broad of a brush. I would suggest that was more like an airless paint sprayer.
I'm sorry.
You left no crevice uncovered. So, Representative
well,
Lindsay.
I was going to follow up, if that would be okay.
All right. Thank you. And I, again, agree with what you say in that we need to make sure that our dollars are invested appropriately. I also think we need to make sure that whatever schools we're looking at here in Oregon, and again, there was one school that does operate in Oregon that we've looked at, and that's important. But we can't infer that schools, just because they are for-profit, are doing things badly or the same as in some other states. So there is that balance, and I think as a member of this committee, I want to make sure that we look at both equally.
Right. Okay. Representative Lindsay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Trying to calm down here. You attract more flies with honey, and I'm sorry, but if you have a beef against career colleges, state it. State it straight up. You win arguments by not yelling the loudest, but by making substantive arguments. I think the purpose of this hearing is an informational hearing on career colleges. We are considering a bill to allow the Oregon Opportunity Grant Oregon students that attend career colleges to apply for and obtain Oregon Opportunity Grant. And I don't know what the purpose of this hearing is except to trash career schools. I think that's wrong. I think it's wrong, and frankly, I'm a little ticked off right now. These schools do serve a function. You just stated so in your testimony. So my question is what purpose do these schools fulfill?
Yeah. Representative Johnson, or Chair Johnson, Representative Lindsay. Well, they fill a niche. There's a lot of well-run schools, for-profit schools that are providing programs that are not necessarily available at the community colleges or at universities, that are, you know, it might be easier for a student to get into these other schools than at a community college. We heard earlier about waiting lists at community colleges. The main point that I want to get across is that if there are resources, public resources, that is going to any institution, we need to make
including
sure
public
that
public institutions.
Including, yes, I agree with that. And we need to have clear standards. And perhaps what we should do, part of my testimony is about, at the federal level, the Department of Education is considering a gainful employment standard for career, for all career colleges, including community colleges, for them to qualify for meeting, for receiving federal student aid. That I would argue that if we do end up providing any kind of Oregon state aid, we should be following whatever standards the Department of Education follows as well.
Yeah, I'm confident we will.
And just to follow up, thank you. Let me help you out with the answer. The niche that I see career colleges fulfilling are nurses that are neighbors of mine, are hair beauticians that are making a good amount of money and feeding their children. I've got a good friend that got his MBA from the University of Phoenix. He's making a lot more money than anybody in this room and hiring a lot more people than anybody in this room. These career colleges play a vital importance in our communities, and they should not be trashed by a handful of bad examples, because every single institution on this earth has bad examples, including this building. Bad examples. And we should not throw the baby out with the bathwater.
I think a quick comment that, again, as I said previously, we need to focus on making sure that we have clear examples of schools in Oregon. However, I have had experiences in Massachusetts working with people who were taken advantage of unfairly, inappropriately by deceitful practices. So I understand that this does exist, and we do need to have standards for where we put our money. And I think that in general is the most important point that you've made, and I certainly value that, although again we've got to keep focused on what's happening in Oregon. But it is a fair point. We do need to make sure students are protected, good businesses are allowed to run, and people that don't follow the rules are called out appropriately, and that we're not putting our public dollars there. So I appreciate that.
Representative Dembro.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And it's really just following up on what Rep. Hoyle just said. I think, you know, our purpose really is to make sure that there's adequate oversight and that the agencies that are doing the oversight are given the resources that they need to do that oversight. Although no Oregon schools were included in the GAO study, my understanding is that there are plenty of Oregon schools that are part of the larger corporations that were part of the GAO study. So I think we have to be concerned. I would not want to, cast any aspersions based on cases that we see elsewhere. There are different environments elsewhere. There's different level of state oversight elsewhere. What we want to make sure is that, you know, Oregon keeps its proper regulatory oversight to make sure that we can have confidence. If we're going to be taking resources, okay, and here's where some of my personal prejudice comes in, if we're going to be taking some resources away, for example, from that could potentially go to community colleges, where the concern here is that not enough, we're not funding community colleges adequately to have the number of slots to offer more nursing, allow more nursing students, are we spending our money wisely by taking it and investing it in this other direction? Perhaps we are, but I want to feel completely comfortable that the money that's being spent in that way is being used well.
Point well taken. And two, I guess I would just add that, you know, the concept of for-profit isn't necessarily offensive to me. They wouldn't be profitable if they weren't providing a product that their consumers appreciated and kept coming back for again and again and again. So that's just my comments. But Emma, would you please weigh in now on this discussion and share with us what you have for us, please?
Yes, thank you very much, Co-Chairs Johnson and Dembro and members of the committee.
I don't want to be repetitive. I understand we have limited time today. So what I'd like to talk about is my students took this conversation very seriously and have spent many hours discussing career colleges and their place in Oregon. And what I'd like to do is share with you some of our concerns with Senate Bill 2297. I do appreciate, Representative Lindsay, that you'd like me to speak more specifically to that bill and the subject of that bill, or at least that's what I'm hearing. And I'd also like to share with a couple anecdotes from students in Oregon, because I think that those stories are important in their experiences with career colleges. My students couldn't...
Could you identify yourself?
Yeah, of course. My students couldn't be here today, but... For the record, then, I'll start. My name is Emma Calloway. I'm the Legislative Director for the Oregon Student Association. We represent students in public universities and public community colleges across Oregon, so as such, that creates some bias with my, from my perspective where I'm coming out from today, but I'll just go ahead and start. So we've already gone over the GAO report and heard a lot about that today. I will say that because we do have concerns with career colleges in Oregon and some of the statistics we see nationally, we are concerned that further diluting the Oregon Opportunity Grant or our ability to access that is one of the major concerns. And one of the reasons that is because of the concerns that we have. So first of all, we would like to say that... we know that for-profit schools across the country use serve students that that access more than $4 billion in the Pell Grant and access also over $20 billion in federal loans. So if you spread that out, and including Oregon as amongst that number, we are seeing that students are accessing these federal loans, and we want to make sure that when they are accessing those loans that they're receiving the best quality education as possible, and also that those loans aren't turned into profits because those are public dollars, and we want them to be used for essential educational services. So that brings me to my next concern, is that sometimes career colleges have an exponentially large recruitment and marketing budget, and we think that when our schools are, when our public schools in Oregon are striving so hard to reach their essential services, to be able to fund our essential services, that's what we're budgeting on right now. It's hard for my students to see where using federal loan dollars makes sense for exceptionally large marketing and recruitment budgets. The next thing I wanted to say is that on average, career colleges across the country have about 12% of students enrolled in post-secondary education, but those students make up 48% of the defaults. And that's one of our major concerns, is that there isn't a lot of skills and financial support for these students to make sure that they're not defaulting on their loans. That's a problem for us nationally, and that's also a problem in our individual states. So default rates is one of our concerns. I'd like to share with you just some anecdotes from stories students wanted to share with me. There are some students in Oregon that have over $100,000 in debt from career colleges, and those students have interest in pursuing further education. And one example in particular is a student who really wants to attend Southern Oregon University and lives in Ashland, but doesn't feel like they have any more debt capacity to take on. And so they will not be pursuing education at Southern Oregon University because their previous degree did give them a lot of debt from these career colleges. Another student who attends the University of Phoenix in Oregon wanted to share with you that she feels that there are very few options with the degree that she received, and there are there was very little personal attention to financial aid and making best use of her degree and moving forward and also keeping her from defaulting. And then at our national conference, we heard from a student that has over $50,000 in debt at an East Coast school and doesn't feel like they can go back and receive education from a public or a private institution because of that level of debt. So those stories are something that are a part of why our students are concerned about House Bill 2297. And I think that we should be doing a better job of addressing those concerns in Oregon before we move forward with giving more opportunity grant to students at career colleges, although we have talked about the importance that they play and the importance in 40-40-20, but our use of the Oregon Opportunity Grant is very special, and we need to make sure that we're doing the very best we can with those dollars. And I spoke to the private schools having a greater level of Oregon Opportunity Grant dollars, and those same arguments are upheld here as well. So Thank you very much, and that's all I have to say, and I'm happy to take questions.
Well, thank you, Emmett, for your very well-reasoned, well-thought-out report. Appreciate that. Now, you know, I think you do bring to light some real concerns as we go forward from this point. You know, we do want to make sure that there's adequate oversight. There's no question about that. And if we do expand that opportunity, they need to be scrutinized. There's no question about that. And I don't think anybody here would argue with those points. So thank you both, and we'll move on now to Sarah Ferguson from PCC. Sandra, pardon me.
Thank you. Hello, my name is Sandra Ferguson, but that's okay since the last 20 pounds I've gained, people refer to me as Sarah all the time. Co-Chair Dembro and Co-Chair Johnson, again, my name is Sandra Ferguson, and I work for Portland Community College in the division of, I'm going to have to look, I'm a little nervous, in the Division of Workforce and Economic Development. Specifically, the college contracts with the state of Oregon to deliver employment and training services to Oregon citizens who have lost their jobs and are on food stamps. And one of the services that are available through taxpayers' money that food stamp recipients have already paid out because they've worked, is vocational training. And so over the last 5 years, I have recommended students to any number of places to go to school. And I will say that Portland Community College, the folks who sign off on these, have never once expressed concern about should this person be going to Portland Community College or should they be going to another institution, or should we be thinking about paying for someone to become certified as a massage therapist or certified as a CNA. So I also want to emphasize that I'm here at invitation as a citizen because in addition to working for PCC for 20 years, I worked for 3 years at ITT Tech as an instructor. I worked at College America for a year and a half as an instructor. And many years and many pounds ago, I worked at John Casablancas Model Talent Management as an instructor. So I kind of represent both worlds, both the academic and the proprietary, and that's still what I refer to them as, our proprietary schools. And I do have copies for you of my remarks. But to get right down to it, I wanted to give you something tangible and measurable because our time is limited. When I talk to a student who wants to go to a proprietary school, first of all, as a vocational trainer or as a vocational representative, it's not my job to tell them where to go. Now, I also advise on campus as an academic advisor. That's different. But when I'm wearing my hat working with Oregon citizens, it's not my job to tell them this is a good school or a bad school or anything. It's my job to help them make a wise choice. And so I always ask them three things. One, is the school you are attending accredited? So if you are going to get a job as a CNA or a job in as a medical assistant, if you want to go forward, what will those credits, how will those credits be used? And I try to explain to them credit and non-credit classes. But that's one of the things I'll ask them. What is the accreditation of the school you are attending? Then I'll ask them about employment. Does the school have an employment program? Do they help you with employment? And offering resume and job search services for a lifetime is a good service. But if you are looking for employment, what percentage of the graduates from the last class in that school have found employment? And what are they working at? And then I will ask them about references because I encourage them to do informational interviews and to go to the schools they're thinking about signing up. And I will tell them, go here, sit down, have a conversation with them, and then come back to me and we'll talk about it. But ask them, What kind of references can their school provide? Are they willing to let you talk to people who have graduated, both happy and not? Are they willing to let you talk to people who are already here? So those are the three things that I will ask. And I asked those three questions of a student not 6 weeks ago, and her response was that becoming a cosmetologist was the dream of a lifetime, and she had secured $21,000 worth of financial aid to become a cosmetologist. I asked my colleagues in the office where I work, most of them work with folks who are receiving public assistance, if they had any stories, successful or otherwise. One of them told me about a young man in the teen program, and 20 years is the limit for participation in the teen. After that, in public assistance, they become part of the adult program. And I think I mentioned it here, $18,000 to attend barber school, and he was still in debt. So those kinds of stories counterbalance the success stories. And those are the things, I think, that we really need to be aware of. I also teach college survival and success, or have, on campus. And these are usually first-generation students. And it's so important that they understand what college is all about. They don't know what a certificate is. They don't know what an associate's degree is. They don't know what a bachelor's degree is. They don't know the difference you were asking about. Terms or semesters, they have no idea. They don't know about accreditation. They don't understand. And those are the things that, if we are all in education together, that it's important everyone does understand. And I was very impressed with Ms. Wickstrom's presentation. I'm so pleased to see that there is an effort to make sure that everybody, whether you're in for-profit or public, are on the same page. And if we can keep working toward that, if we're going to involve colleges in the Oregon Opportunity Grant, then it would seem to me logical that they all have pretty much the same standards. And, you know, I'm not opposed to career schools, and I want you to be very aware that I am not speaking on behalf of Portland Community College. I'm speaking on behalf of somebody who has worked in both arenas, has seen people do well in both arenas, have seen people spend a lot of money and not come out with anything that was going to be useful for them. And, you know, I think I cut it out of here. I had someone from graduate from the University of Oregon. And he's thousands of dollars in debt. But I helped him to prepare for a job at Portland State University. He had his degree from the U of O, which is going to count for more than a degree from a proprietary school. He had contacts at the U of O. He had his portfolio ready from the U of O. So he got a part-time job. It's not going to pay for his schooling, but he had opportunities there that somebody from a proprietary school don't have. But again, I was very impressed to learn about the presentation. So thank you for your time, and if I can answer any questions for you, I'm more than happy
right
to
time.
Do that.
Thank you, Sandra.
You're welcome.
Sure. And question? Jerry?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you for your balanced approach. I certainly appreciate that. And you started your comments with, I think, probably the point of this conversation for me, because I think we've gone down different roads here, and it kind of feels like building cases sometimes. Mm-hmm. And the point of the Opportunity Grant, the point of what I do in education, is to help students and fund students and to fund education, not necessarily a university, not necessarily an institution or any segment of that, because we're not a one-size-fits-all mm-hmm. population. Mm-hmm. And so we need those options. We need the oversight, and it needs to be accountable. And I'm a taxpayer like everybody else in this room. I don't like my dollars wasted any more than anybody else. But I do think I'm sitting here trying to keep my focus on funding students getting an education that is appropriate for them mm-hmm. and useful at the other end. So mm-hmm. thank you for
maybe capturing that at the beginning of your comments.
That is my pleasure. My remarks are probably anticlimactic, but as I went back and looked at my presentation,
very
it,
welcome
seemed,
and
it seems pretty,
pleasing. We appreciate
pretty
it.
Passionate. But,
thank you very much. Appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thank you for your time.
We have some additional written testimony to enter into the record today, too.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Testimony has been submitted regarding experiences at career schools from several students, and this testimony has been submitted by Jeff Berkeley, Sabrina Lloyd, Carmita Ramos, Joseph Peterson, Florence Braggins, and Kristen King, and this testimony is available in the shared drive for the committee.
Thank you. Very nice. Well, with that, committee, we are done with our informational hearings. We have completed the work that's on our plate at this point in time, and pending the arrival of any other additional bills that we need to pay our attention to, we will adjourn our committee and...
We're on spring break.
Yeah.
We're on spring break.